Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your host, Dr. Dana Pang, and myself, Dr. Elise Hutt. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers. Hi, Dr. Pat Awad. Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast.
Hi, Elise. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
Now, to kick us off, I want to give our audience a sense of the roles that you're working and the hats that you're wearing currently. Can you run through the things you're currently doing?
So I'm a neurologist. I think, you know, fundamentally, I'm a physician and my subspecialty area is in neuroimmunology. So what that means is I focus on diseases of the nervous system that have an immunological basis, and the most common one being multiple sclerosis. In Australia, it's quite common actually, and you might be aware that there's this strange geographical relationship with prevalence in MS. So the further you are from the equator, the more likely it is that MS will be present in the population. And Australia has quite a sizable MS population with about 1 in 1,000 adults with the condition. The cool thing about looking after patients with MS is we can do lots of great things these days. There's lots of very good treatments, and that makes it very rewarding to manage professionally and personally to manage. Often we're dealing with people that are in the prime of their working life, and it's quite a hit getting a diagnosis like that, but to be able to do things now and manage very effectively is a huge leap forward. So that is my hat as a doctor, as a neurologist. I've worked in major tertiary institutions. I still lecture at uni and still have my clinics, although I am running far fewer clinics as some of my more entrepreneurial, I guess, avenues have increased over time. So where they lie, I started off with building out medical education platforms and events really focused on specialist training. And they still exist and go on, and they're actually growing. And I think we've probably in some way contributed to the education of at least 5, if not 10,000 trainees over the last decade, through resources that we've created and courses that we've run. That's registrars on the physician side. And then I then got involved with, so where it gets very creative careers in medicine, sort of a little bit different, is I was very interested in consulting to some startups in the healthcare space. And why was I interested? I think that I've always been a little bit creative and I want to collaborate with people, not necessarily just in medicine, but other spheres. So to cut a long story short, I was listening to the radio, sounds old fashioned, but I was listening to the radio at one point and I heard about a healthcare model that was interesting. I tracked that person down. We had a chat about it. I then was introduced to some company directors and chief executive officers, and I started consulting to startups in the primary healthcare space. And that led to eventually partnering with a co-founder and building our first general practice. So at that point, I was a fledgling neurologist and a general practice owner and a medical education provider. And we built a general practice from scratch. And then we sort of focused a lot on community-based care and tried to return some of those old-fashioned values like continuity of care and good multidisciplinary care into the practice, because we know how, I guess, corporatized a lot of healthcare has become. So we wanted to sort of see whether we could introduce some of the more traditional values into good practice, but still make it a good business. And then we did that, and then we acquired another practice and sort of helped to bring that into the 21st century, and then partnered with the government through the pandemic and did a lot of work with the Department of Health to both look after patients with respiratory illness and also increase vaccine access. And then throughout all of that, and prior to that, there was a vision to build a virtual, and that sounds probably more like back to the future-y than it needs to, but really the idea was to create a very robust digital version of primary healthcare where people could access the care, have very good continuity of care like they would in a good practice, and access lots of providers and map out the whole journey for patients. And that's called CU Health. And as time's gone on, that venture has required significant investment. And a lot of my time now, my primary focus when I'm not seeing patients is running that company, CU Health. And CU Health is fundamentally a predominantly digital or virtual, a multidisciplinary healthcare platform. We built the technology with our developers and we've built out the health clinical model that we continue to iterate and refine all the time. And we offer that platform predominantly to companies to look after their employees. And the reason we do that is because busy working professionals, whether they're in the middle of cities or they're regional, don't have time or geographical access to a lot of good preventive services. And also, we know how disconnected it can be when you need allied healthcare services. So one of the things that CU does, and CU stands for Connector, CU Health aims to join all those dots and personalise care for people. And organisations partner with us because more and more organisations are realising that if they look after their employees, then the rest of the organisation is healthier overall, both from a profit perspective and from a real perspective with preventing cancers, improving mental health and all sorts of things. So that's the things I do outside of the fact that I'm a father of three.
Sounds like about four full-time jobs. How much do you actually work clinically at the moment? Do you have a fractionated job?
Yeah, so I used to be 0.5 staff specialist at the hospital and do about a day and a half a week in private. Now I'm doing about a day and a half a week in private doing some research and lecturing. And I'm also a VMO in a private hospital, but I can determine how much I work, which means that about a day and a half, I'm doing very focused clinical work. About half to three quarters of that is in neuroimmunology, which allows me to be very focused and stay on top of that subject matter, which has been important. So thankfully, I don't have to be a master of everything. I can really focus. And that means that I've got to be in a very central part of Sydney to maintain that. And other than that, I am managing a company with lots of investors and employees. So very different.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of different skills. I'm keen to get into how you actually learn all of those other skills and how you juggle it all. But first of all, I want to have a chat about what brought you to medicine in the first place. Do you remember what you were thinking when you decided to apply for medical school?
I do, actually. It will make mum and dad proud. Truthfully, I think that I always loved science. Like a lot of our colleagues, I've always loved science and the curiosity behind it. And I was super nerd in that I loved physics and just how things work. And I think I always knew I wanted to do neurology. You know, I did a medical science degree, majored in neuroscience, and then I just never wavered. So I was one of those lucky people that knew what I wanted to do from the beginning. And that meant I was super focused. And I definitely was not thinking about money or commercialization at all. I mean, neurologists are not known for raking it in. We're very often cerebral and academic and curious now. And as it turns out, we've got great therapies and the world has evolved since I was in med school. So many treatments have come through, which has made us very hands-on. But with that said, I pursued medicine because it was a combination of working with people, and I tend to get along with people. I enjoy getting to know new people, particularly different walks of life. And I got to apply science, and I find the brain fascinating. It's this cauliflower-looking thing that we feel pain with, we feel love with, we move our bodies with. There's so much that this weird organ does. And that was just so curious to me. So I went down, did neurology, very, very pure sort of reasons, I guess. And it made mum and dad proud. So tick that box too.
Yeah, I'm sure you've made them proud. Was it neuroimmunology from the beginning, or was it neurology and then the neuroimmunology focus developed later on?
It developed later on. I think, if I really think about it, you're making me think about stuff that I haven't in quite a while. I loved hematology when I was in med school as well. I found that really fascinating. Hematological diseases, particularly myeloproliferative diseases and the other hematological malignancies, and the way the new treatments evolved, I found really fascinating. So, but I liked the nervous system a bit more. And I thought, well, where can I do B cells, T cells, lymphocytes, and so on, and also the brain. And then, so that was sort of like the academic side. But then I had a great mentor. So a lot of the time it comes down to the people. And I think that a lot of people can relate to this, where you don't quite know what you're particularly passionate about or interested in, and then somebody supports you and piques your curiosity in something and you go down that direction. So a combination of those things happened. And then when you do your specialist training in Australia, and we've got a great, I think, pathway here. You do your general physician training, you get an idea across all specialties, and then you really double down on one. And then within a specialty, as you know now, there's all these subspecialties. It doesn't matter what it is, cardiology, infectious diseases and so on. And in neurology, I did a fellowship in neuroimmunology. I loved it. And I got to experience some really pretty cool stuff young. So I was a registrar at a major hospital and got flown overseas all over the place to international conferences in multiple sclerosis, and just found it. I had no idea that's how it would play out, but it became this combination of research, therapeutic stuff that we could really help patients with. And I stuck on that path and didn't look back.
Cool. And just for my own sake, I learned about this in med school. I've not thought about it again in 10 plus years now. That geographical association in MS. What do we think that is? What's the current theory? I know there was some ideas about vitamin D floating around, but I don't think anyone had a solid answer.
No, I think you pretty much have summed it up. We don't really know, but it's just super interesting that autoimmune diseases generally are less common equatorially, and they're more common, and particularly MS, further from the equator. And there's something to do with potentially the genes in populations of those that are in countries further from the, and why those genes are present, we don't really know. The other thing you mentioned is vitamin D, and really behind vitamin D, there's UV, as you know, and UV activates vitamin D. And so it's probably got something to do with the combination of the gene populations in those environments combined with UV exposure during formative years of life, which are produced potentially an epigenetic phenomenon, which then leads to a cascade of events that makes MS more likely. MS is a multifactorial disease. We know certain things like further from the equator makes a difference. We also know that certain ethnic populations make a difference. We also know that exposure to Epstein-Barr virus or having glandular fever when you're young appears to be an essential precursor to developing MS. So you multiply all of these things together and pop, suddenly you have a central autoimmune. So we don't really know, but we're getting closer to understanding some of these mechanisms.
Glad my knowledge from 10 years ago still holds. Now, moving on to the other things that you do outside of clinical work, I'm interested to see how you actually came to have a lot of your work centered around primary care when you've worked in a tertiary or hospital setting, what it sounds like through your clinical career.
Yeah, I definitely did not plan on that at all. And sometimes I still am doing this kind of work in the primary space, and I think, oh, how did I even end up here? And I think if you look at a lot of business models in healthcare delivery, they revolve around the primary healthcare space. So if you look historically, the first group of medical professionals and specialists were the GPs that were corporatized. And they were corporatized because there was this idea that you could provide shared support to the GPs in an efficient way, in a corporate way, and improve profitability. Now, that's sort of going back 25 years, and I'm talking like I've been around forever when I'm not. I've still got a 3 currently in the first number in my age. That will change pretty soon. But I've had to learn a lot about the commercial and corporate landscape in healthcare. So primary healthcare is the only place other than the emergency department where people come in off the street, so to speak. And so you need to market and all this kind of stuff. But there are rules around marketing in healthcare. So it's a completely different world. As a specialist, you sit in this sort of protected zone where you get referred by the GPs. We're kind of academically protected and our billings are different. So when I was exploring healthcare startups and how I could contribute to solving some problems in the healthcare space, there's just so much out there in terms of the preventative and the primary space. So that's where I landed. There were a few, and I won't name the companies, but there are a few corporate entities looking to bring together specialist services, cancer services and others where the similar model makes sense. It's all the same by the end, at the end of the day. And I don't mean any disrespect to the business people listening to this, but all you're ever really trying to do is find something that creates value and then increase margins by finding efficiencies. And so you fly that to any sector and you've got this similar thing. What you don't want to do is reduce quality of care, and you don't want to break some key rules that are important in medicine. And that does happen sometimes. Actually, it happens all the time in the business world. And that's why a lot of the models break. They break either because doctors don't want anything to do with it anymore, because they say, I don't want to be part of this because this isn't what I was taught. This isn't ethical, or this doesn't fit with our evidence-based practice. Or it breaks because, you know, there's no consultation. There's not actually where the business world doesn't actually speak to the medical world and work it out together. So I'm one of these people. I thought, you know, I've got some different skill sets and perhaps I can be a bridge between medicine and the business world. It so happened that the primary space was the space that was being discussed a lot. I have so much respect for the general practice profession as the coalface, and the fact they have to be across so many things now, and the evidence behind all these things is always increasing. So I think that AI and areas like that are becoming more and more relevant in a space like general practice where you have to cover so much ground. But when you get right down to it, that's all just detailed. Fundamentally, general practice is meant to be the anchor upon which most healthcare revolves in a country. So that provided an interesting space. So I got involved at that level. It sort of just happened. And then I learnt enough to be able to speak the language or the language of general practice. And if I can't speak the language of general practice, I don't pretend. I just simply ask good GPs what they think. And I've learnt a lot that way.
I think that's an important lesson, to be asking people that are involved in it. Having people in healthcare involved in all of these sort of health startups is something that's come up time and time again on this podcast as being very crucial to success of startups. Transitioning from completely clinical into startups and then starting your own business, did you do any formal business training?
I didn't enroll in anything, but I'm very fortunate in that I'm surrounded by lots of people with lots of experience. And I think that one of the things that you'll hear business people say about doctors often is that doctors are very good at what they do, but they're not necessarily good business people. And I think that the reason they say that is twofold. One is maybe their interactions with doctors have been where doctors are inherently intelligent because they had to get through medical school and do it. And people know that. There's a threshold, hopefully, that you have to overcome to be able to look after somebody else's life. Now, the business world often likes to think that they have this secret knowledge as well, like doctors have, but really it's just applying intellect. And I think that when I have discussions with people from other professions, I seek to understand their skill set. But then I just read a lot. I mean, I've got, in my own family, I've got those that have done MBAs. I will talk through things, you know, whether you're going to understand basic financial statements so that you can understand the guts of a business. Well, the interesting thing, though, that I've learned around all of it is they're just tools. It's kind of like a stethoscope in medicine. A stethoscope is useful, but there's so much more that goes on around the art of using the stethoscope as much as the science of it. And really good business people are just really good people. And people can argue that because there are a lot of quite interesting characters that are successful in business, in tech and that sort of thing. But when it comes down to all of it, you'll find that the very, very successful business people, they know to partner with the right people to get the job done. So they may not know everything themselves, but they'll partner with the right people and they'll get them on side. So I think, you know, what I learned was that integrity is important. So you've got to say what you do and do what you say. You've got to be dependable and accountable. And all of those things are very true of medicine. You know, so if you apply them to business, learning the skills of working with accountants and lawyers and reading contracts, that's just a school skill. That's just the same skill we all applied when we did maths and chemistry. And that's just a skill base. So you've got to just do the work and read it. So there's no formal training, but I think that I learned a lot from good people really fast.
What I'm hearing from every answer you've given is just know when to ask for help.
Absolutely.
Were you always inclined toward business? Did you have an interest in it from an early age? Or did it all really come about sort of after your medical training?
I think it came about afterwards. I think I was always more interested in just problem solving. So I didn't think of it as business. And then as I got through my training and then was seeing patients one-on-one, you start to identify whether they're technological problems in the hospital or some sort of inefficiencies in the way. And people get frustrated all the time. You see interns going, oh, why do we do it like this? Could it be better if they had the program like that? You know, you hear a lot of complaints. Why do we give drugs out like this? What about digital prescriptions? There's all these ideas. No one thinks to say, well, some do. Maybe we could fix that. Now, I think I'm a bit like that. And then it just so happens that business is the kind of vehicle you need to solve the problem. Because in order to solve a problem, you need time and you need money. And in order to continue solving problems, you need it to be sustainable. So you need sustainable money, and that's business. And so business is a tool for problem solving. And that's kind of, I think, how I got there.
Interesting. Do you find that you still are learning a lot from both your clinical work and your business work that you take back between the two? Or do they feel like different hats that you're wearing?
Yeah, that's so funny. As time goes on, actually more and more, they nurture each other. And not in the ways that probably people think. So it's not like, oh, I make profit off this one and that one. Not at all. It's more cultural and it's more skill set based. So I'll give you an example. If I'm doing work with CU Health and I'm speaking to our clinicians, the clinicians have far more regard for what I'm saying if they know that I'm still seeing patients. So if I'm still seeing patients and I understand what it's like to be, whether they're this type of patient or that type of patient, we speak the same language, and that allows us to progress clinical models and discussions with a lot of integrity and a lot of momentum. without having me, and again, I don't mind saying this, but some people are sort of sellouts in the business world. And I like staying on the tools. I followed through with my training the whole way through. I've done all the exams, and I'm proud of the fact that I've done that, and that I can then speak to colleagues in a way that makes them feel and me feel like we're the same tribe, we're the same pack, and we're in this together. And that helps fundamentally. It helps with recruitment. It helps with change management. It helps with persuasion. It helps with getting stuff done. It helps with when I've got to be innovative and I've got to cut a corner in business, because sometimes you've got to cut a corner to get somewhere. I can work out how to do that in a way that's responsible, and the clinical team will come around and try and safety net that. So there's a real sense of camaraderie and teamwork when you do it. In the clinical side, so I find that I see lots of patients that obviously are employees within companies or business owners. And because CU Health looks after employees in companies and it sells its services to business owners, I get lots of insights in that regard. But because I work with such a broad group of people across every sector, mining, construction, movie and film, banking, tech, retail, all sectors I'm involved with now, I meet people and I can have really empathetic, detailed understanding of their work and their life, not from a really weird standpoint, but a very specific. It's even got to the point, Elise, where I have some of my patients will ask me for business advice. They'll ask me to help them sell their businesses. They'll ask for legal advice, all sorts of things. And obviously I don't formally give it. And sometimes I put my other hat on as a business consultant and I leave and I help them out in ways that I can. And that's really holistic care. And other times too, in the business world, because I'm a neurologist, I'll meet people and they will book in appointments with me or send their father or mother to me to look after them. So the crossover has been huge.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique crossover. I don't think many people are going to their neuroimmunologist asking for business advice.
No, me neither. I think I'm the only one, probably.
I'm intrigued to find out a bit more about CU Health and the model, how that actually works for the client or customer, whatever you're calling them. So the staff of these companies that are using CU Health, do they access people via telehealth? Is it in person? And other doctors and allied health, do they work exclusively for you, or is it kind of a middleman agent that connects the two?
Okay. I love those questions. I didn't write them, but they're and I think that they're really good questions, because we had to think about all of those really carefully. So it's a platform, and the platform, or there's multiple platforms or portals, we call them. There's the portal that what we would call in medicine a patient logs into, but in CU Health we call them members. So you ask that question, we call them members. Much like you'd be a private health fund member, you're a member of CU Health when you're on board, because you might not be sick, you might be completely well and want to look at improving your diet or something. So the way the journey works like this: an organization will say, we're looking for wellbeing support for our team. We're worried about burnout. We're worried about supporting their overall wellbeing because there's chronic illness within our organization. There might be concern about, you see lots of these things in the media. You know, some companies focus on fertility planning for their employees, or some, now there's a big push on supporting women going through menopause because the impact it has on the quality of life, and businesses have an interest in that. All sorts of things come up over time. But ultimately, we speak with organizations. If they contract CU Health, it's almost like contracting a healthcare practice that's built in a cloud, and that cloud connects in with a company or a government organization, and then employees log on. Once they log on, they're stepping across the threshold to our duty of care. So we very much are independent from the company for security, privacy, and ethical reasons. And we enter into the same duty of care relationship that you would have at a general practice or another practitioner. That moment, though, the experience is very different. So the employee will log on and they may use their personal email address for future correspondence, because that may be what they elect to do. And then they go to a health check. And that health check is an algorithm that's been designed to identify risk factors and past medical history for that person, so that we can make sure their care is personalised the right way. Actually, Steve Gluckman, who will be attending Careers in Medicine, helped me build that. So we built that journey, and the employer uses it, and they may identify they've got poor sleep, perhaps they want to improve their diet, maybe they're smoking and have considered quitting. They'll receive personalised content based on what it is that they've chosen or what it is they've answered. And they land on their dashboard. On their dashboard, they can personalize their healthcare, their content library, They can book appointments. Those appointments are telehealth consultations. Some of them are your standard type of consultation. Some of them are well-being checks or annual health check. There is psychology, there's performance coaching. So one of the things we learned is organizations don't just want support when you're really suffering. They may also want to optimize performance and help people with resilience, prevent burnout. So we offer all those kinds of services. And when you look under it all, what we're trying to do is identify people who are suffering or disordered currently with a chronic physical or mental health problem and help support that person back to health. We collaborate with external providers where needed, but all the providers at CU Health Engage are directly employed or contracted to us. So we're not a middleman at all. We're actually, I would call, a national department where in the public hospital you would see specialists, nursing staff, allied health staff all collaborate to provide a management plan for a patient. We provide that similar model with multidisciplinary care directly under the umbrella of CU Health for the members or patients that use the service. And that means we can be very outcome focused. And that's how we do it. And then we aim to provide an environment that is really cool and engaging for the healthcare provider because they get to do all kinds of preventive care or subacute care. Obviously, acute stuff we don't do because you can't really do that virtually. We do some face-to-face stuff, but we don't do what emergency departments or general practitioners do in the physical setting. But there's all this other stuff. You can look after eating disorders, you can look after celiac disease, you can look after depression, and you can look after that with dietetic involvement, you can look after it with psychology and GP involvement in a multidisciplinary way. So there's this kind of collegiality in there, and I love that. And that was one of the things that I wanted to really bring to life in this system, which I'm not seeing or did not see much in the traditional telehealth space, which was very marketplacey, next available, and with full respect, that's not actually healthcare, I don't think. To me, that's service-based transactional care, and you're not going to get that long-term therapeutic relationship or outcome as quickly.
No, sounds amazing. It sounds like a big change in the structure of the system. Speaking more from personal social experience than from my healthcare work, because I've not worked in the primary space, but I don't feel like many people go to any sort of health professional for preventative stuff.
You know, all of the research and all of the public health work that comes out clearly identifies that an overwhelming percentage, a majority percentage of chronic illness that we have in our communities is preventable or can be delayed by a decade or more with appropriate prevention. Now, behaviours are hard to change and people's lifestyles, their demographic and their health literacy is hard to change. But if you have an embedded system that's user-friendly and that you can provide access to through employers, which is why we went this direction, you have an opportunity to move the needle, and that's a pretty corporate term, but you have an opportunity to shift the curve much earlier in someone's life and give them tools that will help them prevent chronic illness. And I think, like, you know, I always speak on that one in two working Australians have about one chronic illness, and that chronic illness list is long. It can be anything from hypothyroidism, endometriosis, PCOS, chronic migraine, arthritis, whatever it might be. But people are living with that. Now, some people can prevent that. Some people can optimize their management. But you don't really go, we know healthcare costs are rising. People don't rush out to their GP to say, well, what are the next 12 things I should do to prevent a heart attack in 20 years? And mental health is the elephant in the room in that there are so many things you can do to make someone more protected with respect to their mental well-being. There are lots of tools that require a little bit of accountability and a few nudges, and that's where digital is great. You can provide that in a much more user-friendly way. The other part of it that's important is getting along with your providers. I mean, sometimes you're referred to a psychologist, you might not get along with them. Then you think, oh, I've got to go back to the GP to get a different psychologist and just give up. In the digital world, you can provide options and someone can choose who they like. And if it doesn't work out, they can change more quickly. There are many aspects to it, and I don't speak on them very often because it depends on the type of podcast I'm on. But because there's a lot of medical people know that we are orchestrated through Medicare, and it's a great, I mean, Medicare is an amazing benefit to being an Australian citizen and to being a resident here. It needs lots of review. It has ongoing review all the time. It certainly needs to be reviewed now, and there's a lot of work going on there. But because CU Health offers its services to organisations outside of Medicare, we can kind of do things the way the textbooks would have us do them, a bit more the way that we'd like to work as healthcare professionals. We're not, it's very evidence-based. As a matter of fact, sometimes Medicare kind of makes you do things in an order that's unnatural, a bit odd. When you don't have to follow things in that way, you can reimagine the digital-first approach to getting outcomes and prevention. So CU Health is allowed for all of that.
I'm very excited to see where this all goes in the future. I think a lot of these conversations we'll be having at the CCIM conference, which will have happened by the time this goes out, which is very exciting.
Oh, great.
Now, it sounds like you're doing an awful lot, wearing an awful lot of hats. Do you have any tips or tricks on how you actually juggle all the different roles? Are you a big time blocker or any other particular things that you do to keep your head in the game for all of the different things?
I don't know if I've worked that out. So I wouldn't pretend to. And I think there's a lot of stuff out there about how people do it and diarizing things properly and exercising at a certain time and sleep hacking and all this stuff. And I mean, I come at this with a lot. I've got a fair bit of experience and I'm also a neurologist. So I think about the brain a fair bit. I've tried to work out how to answer these kinds of questions because people do ask, how do I juggle it and things don't break? And I think things micro break all the time and I'm trying not to be in repair mode all the time, but you know, I'm constantly trying to repair things as much as I'm trying to move forward. As long as you're moving forward more than you're repairing, you're winning. At the core of it all, I think it comes down to having direction. So I think I don't want to be sound too lofty, but I think that if you kind of know where you want to end up in 3 to 5 years, if you can see that, then it helps you decide on what is important in 10 minutes, in 1 hour or tomorrow. And that helps with decision hierarchies and prioritizing. And so the analogy I give is sometimes sort of when I was on the wards a lot, one of my skills, which was something that some others maybe didn't have as much, was the ability to prioritize which patients needed more care, which investigations needed to be ordered first. You see some interns and residents stay on the wards till 11 o'clock at night when they technically finished at 6 o'clock. And you see others knock off on time. And some left on time because not so good reasons, and some left on time because they just got through their stuff. And I used to be one of the ones that got through their stuff, and I think that I did really well by my patients. I didn't get any complaints, so that was nice, and I got along well with my consultants. And I think that's just because there's a bit of a matrix that forms in your mind when you know what matters and what doesn't, and then you can time manage better. And I think you need to watch people that happen to be good at that. They can't kind of explain it. And watch them, how they do it, what they sweat. They don't sweat the small stuff. I mean, I'll tell you, the thing that throws the biggest crowbar into my day would be interpersonal conflict. So I could be going fine. It doesn't matter how hard the challenge is, you know, like climb this mountain, fine, do it. That's just hard work. But if there's something that slows me down, it would be an unnecessary confrontation with somebody. So a lot of that slows me right down. And then I spend a fair bit of time making sure everyone's okay. So I know that if I make sure the people are okay around me, then that clears the space for me to get stuff done. So that's very different than what you hear about waking up, meditate. It's actually making sure that my family are okay. They may not be perfect. It's making sure my team is okay. So then I've got a clear run at being productive. Then the next thing after that is like pretty much in business, what do you do? You rank things in accordance with the opportunity. So I will go to the emails that connect with the biggest business opportunity first. And I make my way down the list. In medicine, you go to the high security stuff first and you triage it, you make your way down the list. And it all needs to add up to a puzzle that fits with the vision that you want in 5 years. So you don't go off course, because what you don't want to do is swim west when you're meant to go east. So having that anchor point is super important. So this is a very philosophical answer. I hope there's something practical in there for people, but that's kind of how I do it.
No, I liked it. I feel like that was quite a unique answer. I appreciate that. And while we're on the advice train, do you have any advice for people wanting to transition into startups or business from a clinical perspective?
The first thing I would say is that medicine's amazing. So having tasted lots of different kinds of careers all at once, I can say with complete conviction that it really is a privilege to look after people and use science to do that and be generally respected by the community that we live in. It's a great thing. And the grass is often not greener on the entrepreneurial side. I'll say that first. The second thing I'll say, though, is if you've got an itch to build an app or to build out a clinic that's a bit different and you just feel like you'll regret it if you don't have a go, then definitely go for it, because regret is one of my fears, I guess. I want to have sort of done as much as I can in terms of what I'm interested in and my skills. And I think if you've got that nature, then go for it. The next thing would be to say that don't reinvent the wheel. Speak to people that have done it before. Personally, I love that mentorship side, practical stuff. What does a contractor agreement look like? What does a license agreement look like? How do you read a profit and loss? What's a good structure to go into partnership, trust, all this stuff I've been involved with in some way. And the last thing you want to do is if you're a clinician and you're spending with, is go to lawyers and accountants and get them to and pay them. So I would say go to other medics that have done it. I would say that if you genuinely care about people, align your values with the business so that you don't burn out. Because one of the reasons I haven't burnt out yet, although I've got close, I've probably burnt out lots of times, but I just kind of keep going, which isn't the best advice, but you know, it would be worse to stop, I think. But I think what I'm trying to say is make sure that what you do aligns with something that really matters with you, and don't be persuaded otherwise, because that's when you burn out. You really burn out when you're doing things that don't align with your personal values, and there's no good reason to keep going. So, and money doesn't help that, that's for sure. So, you know, they're the big things I'd say. Ask people that have done it before to help you out.
That's all very sage advice. I think a bit different from what you normally hear, both from the health and the business side of things. So love that. Now, our final question, which we ask everyone that comes on the show, is if you could do something else outside of health and outside of the sort of roles that you currently do, do you have a dream job in an alternate reality?
Yeah, I do. It's a music producer.
Oh, amazing. What sort of music would you produce?
I like lots of music. I think that, it's going to sound, people are going to laugh. I probably have a hip hop record label if I could, just because I love hip hop and I like how, you know, neurology and everything is very conservative, whereas the hip hop label is completely unconservative. So I just go completely the other direction. But I could definitely do other stuff. Like I love all kinds of music. I love jazz. I love classical music. I love rock. But I just love being around that environment. So one of my goals is to probably do more music stuff. If ever I get a chance and I'm not involved with, you know, around the clock growing businesses and focusing on all of those things, if I can get to the point where I've got a little bit more freedom of my time, I will do more music stuff to balance out the last decade.
Is that what you do music-wise? Do you produce music as a hobby, or do you play instruments or just listen to music?
No, I play the piano sometimes. I've got a pretty musical family. Actually, my uncle's great jazz pianist. One of my cousins is a singer. So, you know, music and creative stuff is sort of in our family, and I've always loved that side of it. Even I've been fortunate enough that on the CU Health side, our investors, we've got lots of different kinds of investors. Some of them are in the entertainment industry, both film and music. And that's kind of been a fun way of, you know, like I get to go onto movie sets and stuff like that just for fun as part of. So sometimes that's what business can give you. It opens the door to different places you would never go. And yeah, I love lots of things. I love sport and I haven't been playing as much as I used to. But I think that music would just be such a fun outlet.
Yeah, cool. Amazing. I look forward to hearing your hip hop beats in 10 years time or something. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been amazing to chat to you.
Thanks a lot, Elise. You've been great.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. Visit the Creative Careers in Medicine website in the show notes of this episode for more resources to help you find the courage, confidence, and skills to take control of your career and forge your own unique path. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water, and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and to elders past, present, and emerging.